Today is May 31st, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM on the internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Our website is pcradioshow.org. The Personal Computer Show on WBAI-FM has been preempted this evening for a membership drive. We will not be on tonight at 9 p.m. However, even when we are preempted on WBAI for fundraising, we continue to do a regular broadcast each week on PRN.FM. Our broadcasts are available for downloading from PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website, PCRadioShow.org. The WBAI archive may list us as the program of record with the replacement program. However, the program may not necessarily reflect our views. More specifically, we do not endorse the premiums or the views pitched by last week's replacement program. And I'm Hank Key, and I'm in the studio of PRN, and I'm very happy to say that I have Joe King in the studio with me. The only disappointment I have is you didn't bring the tequila with you.
No, I didn't, but what is that sound effect you're using?
Oh, come on. You're old enough to know what that is.
That was sounded just like a 1939 Smith Corona typewriter.
I don't know if it was a Smith Corona. It might have been a Remington.
No, my Remington is much nicer sounding.
Hey, Joe, I got to tell you, you know, there's a pricing war on shipping charges and membership with Walmart and Amazon. I just want to let you know that Amazon is, we've been buying a lot of stuff there. My wife just recently joined the premium program for 1 month at no cost at all, and I thought it was a good deal.
Well, it is a good deal. The program that she joined normally sells for $100 a year, but it includes unlimited free two-day shipping.
Yes.
So if she orders a lot of packages, then she'll break even.
And then she says to me, this is easy to use. It's one-click transaction.
Yes. That is something that you and I have joked about for a long time, but we're joking about it on the other side. Hank, that's a very dangerous procedure. I can't tell you how many times I used to click it by accident and have to then go in a more involved way and cancel the order. I no longer have one-click feature on my computers. I don't want it. I don't like it. But, you know, one of the things that is really good about that new policy of the free shipping that comes with, what do they call it, the Prime, not
Prime,
Premier,
right.
Is you get Amazon Movies, you get Amazon Books, you get Amazon Music free to listen to read, to watch. It's not part of your permanent library. But how often do you really reread a book or re-listen to it?
Hey, Joe, you know what you just told me, that you're an impulse buyer?
Yes, absolutely. Once I've done the research on something, I'm tending to order it.
So why would you not want that one-click transaction if you've done all the research?
Because I might be thinking I'm going to go and read more, check the guarantee, check the shipping availability, and instead I punch that one-click button by mistake.
I got to tell you, thank God we got people like you, Joe King, because you help the economy.
Well, I don't, sadly, and I feel ashamed of it, I don't help my local economy because I've been buying more and more from Amazon.
Well, as you know, Amazon now charges where it's applicable sales tax, so the local people shouldn't complain now, right?
Well, you tell that to all the shopkeepers in my neighborhood that I still say hello to, but I don't buy from. I'll say, hey, I'm not hurting you. I'm paying sales tax.
Well, I can tell you that in my neighborhood, we have two Home Depots only half a mile from each other. Now, that is business, that huge volume business.
And are they losing business to?
No, not at all.
You're sure? You've talked to the store managers in each case and the warehouse managers? No, Hank, you haven't, because I know
Me. Can I tell you what their big ticket item is? Trees, plants, bushes.
Yeah, that they're not going to lose. And they're also not going to lose too much on their major appliances. But it's the little things that you walk in and, hey, I need a new picture hook. That they're going to lose their business on.
Hey, you know,
the other thing is, I got to point out that Amazon is now one of the top five capitalized companies in this country. They're not suffering either.
No, they're not. By the way, Joe, I want to make sure that we let the audience know that there's a major update on the WannaCry ransomware, because it's no longer a single ransomware thing now. It's there's a lot of copycats out there using similar names. So, and many of them start off with a wanna, but don't be surprised if some of these don't even come close to the name, just to fool you. And Microsoft has been at least four different patches or that they've already issued. So major thing is that we should have, you know, the operating system, just take it and make sure, don't hold off on updating.
That is the very, very least. Hank, I'm surprised that you put it that way. You make people think that if they update their operating system, they're safe.
No, what I want to say is it's not confined to XP or 7. It now is hitting other versions of the operating system.
Indeed it is, and it's still equally dangerous. There are some software protection programs, and there are some that will actually clean it out of your system. If you do, I can't give it all to the listeners right here, Hank, but if they do a search on Google for WANA malware, WANA Crypt, WANA, I'm sorry, I lost the last name.
WannaCry, WannaCrypt, WannaCrypto. What do you want, WANA?
but lead it with WANA, and on Google, you'll find even some places that will download to you software that'll clean it out.
Now, if you want to follow it more closely, we have a colleague, Michael Horowitz, and he's a columnist, and he writes a column called Defensive Computing on Computer World. So if you just do a search on Michael, Computer World, Michael Horowitz, Horowitz, and he comes up with all the details on it if you want more information on it.
And you can get it on the web, so just remember Computer World, Michael Horowitz, and Defensive Computing.
Now, we talk about WannaCry. Now there's another thing that is just came out, and I don't know how many people are aware of it, called Judy. You know, like Judy, you know.
Who said Judy?
Who's that actor? Clark Gable.
I'm not going to even tell you.
No, I know who it is. You know, sometimes you see the face, and if I'm no longer with you, it comes right back, okay?
The malware Judy is a really vicious, nasty, disgusting, they should all be thrown in jail. The inventors, most of them came from Korea. I have nothing against Koreans, but I have a lot against malware from Korea. The reason I say that is you'll find these programs, most of them are Android, but you'll also find some of them for iOS.
Well, why don't you explain what Judy is?
Judy is a character in Punch and Judy, which was a puppet show many years ago. The first one was found in a program that was based on Punch and Judy, and that's why they call the malware Judy. What the malware doesn't really affect you. Once it's on your machine, it goes back out to another server, not a Google server, not a Google Play server. It goes out to its home server and downloads a program that, invisible to you and transparent to you, clicks on links that appear on your page And those links cost the advertiser money because it's treated as a hit on the link. That you don't actually go to the link, but it just registers a hit on the link. A very nasty piece of software. And the reason it's able to get into the App Store or the Play Store is because it's clean at that point. It does have code that later goes out and downloads the malware. It can be found that way.
Well, there's been reported over 35 million phones have already been infected by it.
Oh, I should have said this infects the cell phones. I didn't mention that.
Now, when you say cell phones, are you talking about Android only, or what about iOS?
Most of them are Android, but a significant number have been hit with iOS.
Well, how do you know you have it since it's done silently in stealth mode?
I can't tell you that, Hank, but I suggest that everybody do their own research on it.
Well, is there a place you can find out, like, do I have it? Is there a test for it? I guess we don't. I guess if we find out, we're going to let people know. Huh?
Well, I first found out about it from my good friend and mentor, Hank. But he didn't give me all the answers.
Well, the thing is, because I am very careful about what I put on the cell phone. It's very limited. I don't go crazy. If I want to go crazy on the web, I do it on a laptop I have that does nothing else on it. In other words, I got one of those. By the way, I'm doing a series. Like, when do you know you need to buy a PC? And one of the things is you just want to dedicate just downloads and you don't care what happens to it. And you know what? We'll find more about it. But if you were to do a search on Android Space Judy, you'll get more information on it.
And if you want some really good information, the people who discovered this malware are Checkpoint, CHECK, second word, point, POINT, Software Technologies Limited. They're pretty much a multinational company. They have several websites. You can go just do a Google search for Checkpoint and Space Judy, and you'll get all the information you really need. Or, on the other hand, you could go over to Europe or the Middle East and drop in on one of their local offices.
No, don't they have an office in the United States?
They do. It's in a place called San Carlos, California.
Well,
I don't really know where that is.
Well, if the weather's good, maybe we should go there, huh? Hey, Joe, did you know that the Supreme Court had a ruling yesterday that affects virtually every computer user?
Do you know that the Supreme Court had a ruling yesterday that affects virtually every owner of anything?
You better tell the people what it is. And by the way, once you tell the people what it is, I would like you to tell them, because I couldn't find it. You did. What was the vote count?
I'm not positive, but I believe that it was 7-1. But I'm not positive. It might have been 8-0, and just Ruth Bader Ginsburg might have just withdrawn from one of the points, which had to do with international sales. What people have been doing in the past is, for the most part, is that they've been buying a printer. This is what brought it about.
Well, actually, the original case was with a Lexmark printers.
And Lexmark came up with a way of assuring that when you ran out of ink, you had to buy Lexmark ink. Although other people were perfectly willing to sell ink for the printer at a fraction of the price, Lexmark put some sort of a chip into the cartridge. And if you didn't have that chip, you couldn't print. Pretty soon, other companies in the third-party, what would it be called, the third-party refill business?
Yeah, you know what they do? So you drill a hole in the cartridge, and then you fill it up with ink and patch the hole, and guess what? You can sell the cartridge. Can you?
Well, what you couldn't do with the Lexmark was hide that chip. So you had to come up with some solution for the chip. And the solution that on Lexmark they came up with was to use the old cartridge instead of just drilling out anybody's cartridge that would fit in. The other manufacturers quickly came up with different ways of accomplishing the same thing. HP, for example, when you bought it, had a, I think they call them a shrink pack license that you would not reuse the cartridge. And you agreed to that after you paid for the cartridge.
And by the way, after you break open a package, then you could read it, and then they say if you open the package, you accept it. I mean, like, it's a catch-22.
Now, there's always a situation where you start getting into the laws of unintended consequences.
Joe, before you say that, all the lower courts had said Lenovo was right.
The other things that happened concurrently with this is that Wiley, the book publisher, was selling his books, educational books, over in Europe for a fraction of what they were charging here. So some clever guy went over to London or Malaya or Singapore, Hong Kong, bought up all the Wiley books, brought them back here, added on 15 or 20%, was still much cheaper than Wiley, and Wiley got very, very upset. That became an issue. Then pretty soon people realized that anything that you own is available someplace else cheaper. And instead of just buying it for yourself, going up to Canada, you would buy enough of them, bring them back, and sell them to all your family members. This was all very good until this Lexmark case where they sued, Lexmark sued on the basis of patent infringement, not contract violation, not copyright law, patent infringement. Now, granted, what happens in the world of patent infringement is very close to what happens in the world of copyright, so everybody was following this case very, very carefully. And one of the lower courts ruled that you can't do that. If I have a patent on it, you can't just automatically say that you're going to use my stuff. Well, the case that came before the Supreme Court was on the life of the patent, and it turns out that the Supreme Court agrees with Hank and me, and that's nice of them, that the patent rights of the patent owner are transferred to the person who buys the merchandise. Once I own it, Lexmark no longer has any patent rights on it. I can then do with it what I want. And if what I want to do with it is drill a hole in it, refill it with ink, and sell it to you, that's legal. And that changes a whole bunch of things, not just for the ink business. Think of how many different third-party manufactured parts are in your automobile.
Well, I know that when someone buys a very expensive sports car, many of them change the hubs with a fancier hub. And They modify it. And
well, this is something else. Think of, have you ever bought a used car? I have. I want to buy it not from an individual, but I want to buy it from a dealer because an individual is understood not to guarantee or warranty the car, but the dealer is expected to warranty the car. It's a factor of the intent of resale, the commercial law. And I know before they warranty it, they're going to have their mechanics go through the car and refurbish the brakes and refurbish the whatever, all the different parts.
With available parts.
With available parts. Not necessarily original equipment parts, but whatever they can get inexpensively in the third-party market. According to this law, that's fine. They can do that. According to the people, Lexmark, who brought the lawsuit, they cannot do that. That would have ended the used car market. Couldn't happen. Even if I believe, Hank doesn't agree with me, but I believe that even if the Supreme Court didn't agree with the lower court, they would never have ruled for Lexmark. It would have been
terrible. But one thing that surprised me is that all the lower court rulings was, you can't do it. And I'm surprised by that because it went through all that level and the Supreme Court overruled everyone.
Yes, because they realized that the rights of the patent holder end when he sells the item that's patented.
Well, let me ask you, were you surprised that the vote was that lopsided?
No.
You weren't?
Well, yes and no. Let me say, I was not surprised from a logical point of view. I was surprised from a political point of view.
Now, when I read this article, I said to myself, okay, suppose I'm the manufacturer. Because the principle on it is Lexmark, okay? How might they redesign it so that they can get around this? And I said to myself, not going to work. You know why? if you redesign it, someone will buy somebody else's product. Because a inkjet printer is a commodity item that there's really nothing special about it, you know. It really isn't. They're all pretty much alike.
Well, Hank, the problem that I see it...
Now, I have a question. If I were to go back in time with a Gillette razor, is there anything that is similar to it?
Well, I don't really think so, because we've all used Gillette, Schick, other razors.
Some more than others.
And we all knew the history of Gillette, which was imitated by Schick and others, was to give a very low price on the razor and a very high price on the razor blades. Even when the competition was and they came down significantly in the price on the razor blades, still they were charging $2-3 for a pack of razor blades. A razor blade was lasting for 2-4 days, and there were a tremendous volume of razor blades being sold for little money, but that money added up, and Gillette and others became very wealthy on it. I don't recall there ever being a time, and I could be wrong, when I couldn't buy, well, I know definitely I could buy single-edged razor blades from third-party manufacturers. I don't know whether I could buy double-edged blades. I never tried to, so I really don't know about that.
Well, I think it's good news for the consumer. Let's put it this way. We're biased towards the consumer, for the consumer.
I do know this with the current blades, and I'm now using yet another Gillette razor, and this one now has 4 blades. Last year's had 3 blades. A couple of years ago, it was 2 blades for the razor. I haven't seen anybody making Mach 3 razor blades for Gillette, and maybe that's because of the patent, and what they just don't worry about the razors anymore. They're now making the money on selling the blades.
Hey, Joe,
a pack of blades now cost me $5.
You know, your alternative is grow a beard. Hey, Joe, I got to tell you about another news item that will impact many of the users. You know, the ARM chip with Qualcomm has made inroads with computers. First of all, you know, the ARM chip was basically for the smartphone, but they, working with Microsoft, has come up with some low-cost, or they will be coming up with some low-cost computers using the ARM chip. And the good part, the pros about the ARM chip is that it's very, very low-powered, so that you can actually have a very long usage before you have to recharge. The problem, however, is it lacks power. Now, Intel, to compete against the ARM chip, has been basically, in the past, using the Atom chip and slowing it down. And it's that when they do slow it down, it's still faster than the ARM chip, but they really can't quite match the ARM chip in terms of power usage. So they finally said, you know what? With Microsoft really giving them the kick by saying they're working with other processors to put Windows 10 on, they've come up with a new chip, and the new chip is called, I have it here, this way. The new chip is called Gemini Lake. So don't confuse that with their current chip called Apollo Lake, all right? Now, the Gemini Lake code name that they use is really a completely redesigned Atom chip. So whereas Qualcomm was trying to, you know, they have a new chip on the board to get more power, and Intel has this basically try to get lower power but with more chip. Now this chip, Gemini Lake, sort of like it's the best of both worlds, and they plan to have notebooks released with this sometime in the fourth quarter. So, Joe, my comment, and I think you agree with me, is that, you know, when you need a machine, you just buy what's available, because that's the model you should have. But if you really don't have an urgency to buy a machine and you want to buy a low-end machine, hey, wait for this new chip.
Well, now I'm going to ask you a question you weren't expecting me to ask.
Yeah.
What does ARM stand for? What does ARM mean?
I know what RM stands for. RM stands for reduced machine set.
Actually, it doesn't.
It doesn't?
And I did this just because I think it's been 8 years since the last time I was able to stump you.
Yeah.
ARM stands for Acorn Risk Machine.
Well, risk is reduced instruction.
I'm going to say, what does risk mean? So it's Acorn Reduced Instruction Set Computing Machine.
I was really mostly right, except for the A, okay, the Acorn. Come on.
Now, Acorn used to be a significant manufacturer.
Yes.
I don't think they're around anymore.
Well, there are a number of them using the ARM.
Because the company that is using ARM architecture is ARM.
Well, what it is that the...
ARM Holdings is their
actually, they form a holding company and they license the ARM instruction set to all the people who are, is trying to use reduced instruction set. And that's like the standard that's used as the ARM set.
But for those who are interested in trivia, they started the ARM architecture just about 2 years after we started this program. It was 1985.
Well, we started this program in 1983, and I know that Joe...
Well, when we started, were we 32-bit or 64-bit?
How about 16-bit? No, seriously, 16-bit. The 8080 was a 16-bit chip, and the 32 didn't come into being until the 386 was introduced.
Well, it's now 32-bit or 64-bit.
Now it's 64 now.
But they introduced the 64-bit in 2011. I'm reading all of this, incidentally, from my smartphone, which has on it a page from Wikipedia. I don't want you to think I'm smart. I just know how to read.
No, wait a minute. You're smart. I'm going to ask you a question, okay?
Wait, I got to look it up.
Yeah? You know what the question is?
Whatever it is, I'm sure I don't know.
Well, we've been doing this show now for over 30 years, and... You back up regularly, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You want me to believe that?
No. But if you do believe it, I want to talk to you about this bridge I have for sale.
It's called Backup Bridge, right?
No, it's called the Brooklyn Bridge. And Hank, you'd love if to own it. It's got nice architecture. And you could put in some toll bridges on each side of it. Nobody would notice.
Hey, by the way, I just want to touch on this briefly because I've been looking into it. And one of the questions that I'm always asked is, I have such and such a machine. Do I need a replacement machine, a new one? And there's no straight answer, but I started working on it, and I came up with two postulates, if you can call that, okay? And one of them is, if you're a collector of computers, yeah, sure, go buy it. And the reason why is because I looked at all the computers I have. I have two very old machines that it kind of sits there because it's historically, it's a collector's item. And you're going to say, what two machines is that? I said, well, one of them I don't use anymore is a Cromemco S100 system. And you just made a face and say, what the heck is that?
That's not even an old machine. That is a machine. Back in the days when you went out hunting for dinner and you came back with a Tyrannosaurus, you might have had that machine.
No, actually, what it is that... there were two companies in 1975 that came up with the machines. One most people is aware of is the Altair from MITS, M-I-T-S. And the other one was from Sphere Corporation, and it was called Sphere 6800. Those were the two machines that came out. And obviously the Altair was most popular and so on. And
I happen to know for a fact that you had a computer several years before either of those.
No, well...
It was called an Abacus.
Well, I think that when I was born I had it, okay, if you want to put it that way. But the the Altair used what is called an S100 bus, and then IMSI came up with a more of a standardized way of a kit putting it together, and it was widely very popular. It's a lot was sold, and Cromemco, what they did was they modified the front panel. You're talking about mods and so on, and I bought that as a kit, and it had a Z80 chip instead of the 8080 chip, and the other day I was going to throw it out or donate it and so on, and someone said to me, have you gone to eBay to see what it's worth? Yesterday, I couldn't find it on eBay, but when I did look it up last month, I couldn't believe that people were asking $10,000 for it.
for historical purposes.
It's a historical item.
Right.
And I was going to modify it and just take the front panel off so I have blinking lights and hang it up in the living room. You know what they say about antique furniture and anything? Don't touch anything on it. If it looks old, don't remove the,
Yeah, that's right.
Don't remove anything on it. However, there's a machine that is so old that I'm still using. I can't believe it.
What's that?
You have the same machine, and I think you still use it. No, actually, I don't really use it anymore. The original netbook that came out from ASUS.
I still use it, actually.
No, you don't. You don't have it.
Yeah. Oh, the 150?
No, the EEEPC was the original netbook.
No, that I gave away, but I do still use a netbook from...
Acer,
not ASUS, but it's quite old. The first computer I really fooled with was a thing that was called K-Pro 2.
Ah, that's way after my time.
That was in 1982, and it was a portable, Hank. It only weighed 26 pounds.
By the way, one of the things that I talked about that I'm going to be spending time is that one is if it's a collector's item, yeah, you know what? So you go buy another computer. But another is you still use it, and if you start cursing at it, that's the time to buy another machine.
Oh, no, that is not a good rule.
Yeah?
Generally, when I'm setting it up, right before I plug it into the wall, I'm cursing at it. Brand new machine.
But there's one reason why you want to buy a new machine, and this is the funny part because it's coming from me, all right, is that, wow, the price is so good, I can't afford to not buy it. Have you ever heard people use that term?
No.
Oh, yes, you have. So what happened was that last Black Friday, there was a sale on a Dell laptop, and the price was so good that I said, I got to buy it. And I figure if I don't want it, someone will take it off my hands. I bought it, and guess what? I'm using it. And you know why I don't mind using it? It's so cheap that if I bang it around, I don't care. If I lose it, I don't care. Those are the kind of machines I like to use.
Indeed, Hank. That's always a good way to go.
By the way, I just want to tell you that we have two great segments to follow this. We have Dr. Alfred Poor. He's going to be talking about diabetes and other things. And, he's been concentrating on health issues, and I think it's worthwhile listening to. And we have Marty Winston. He's going to talk about, some things that you really should be considering, especially fire, because you got to be concerned fire outside the house besides inside the house.
And come back again next week, same time on the same station, and Hank and I will be happy to chat with you what we know about computers.
And let's get to the feature segments.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. I want to talk about diabetes, and in specific, I want to talk about one of the common complications that accompanies diabetes, and it's called diabetic retinopathy, and it's really just a fancy name for damage to the retina, the nerves in the eyes that convert light to energy and allow you to see things. It's caused by circulation problems and other issues that come from having diabetes. It's a serious, serious problem. The longer you have diabetes, the more likely that you'll have this retina damage. The leading cause for blindness for people aged 20 to 64 is, in fact, diabetes. So it's a big issue. The sad part is that, according to some sources, as many as 95% of all these cases, the loss of vision could be avoided with early treatment. The problem is that it takes careful screening by an expert to identify the problem so that you can start the treatment and prevent the loss of vision. It's a process that requires specialized training, and it's time-consuming, and it's subjective. It's not just something you look at and immediately say, oh, this is good, this is bad. You know, you have to sort of learn the ropes and have a lot of experience. One of the things that's happening is computers are getting very good at learning. IBM researchers have taught a computer system to make a diagnosis about diabetic retinopathy. And they've done this by taking the artificial intelligence system and exposing it to more than 35,000 sample images of retinas and telling them, you know, which ones are healthy and which ones aren't. And then they train the system to identify the kinds of lesions that are indicative of this disease. They then had the computer system make an assessment of the risk, just like a trained physician would. And then the system had to score the image based on five different levels, ranging from no disease to proliferative disease. They found that the system was 86% accurate in terms of classifying the severity of the disease. And the big thing about it was it only took 20 seconds for it to look at an image and come up with a conclusion. This is in comparison to the long time that a trained technician or physician would have to spend examining a patient's eye to make a determination. The big point here is that this is another case where digital health can automate some of the difficult diagnostic procedures that need to be done and do them very accurately. In fact, in many cases, maybe do them better than a human. So it's faster, more accurate, and easier. In this case, it could well lead to more diabetic patients being diagnosed correctly to the severity of any retinal disease that they might have and getting treatment sooner and saving their eyesight, which will not only help them with their quality of life and make their lives much better, but it's also going to save them lots of money and the health system a lot of money over time. So deep learning and artificial intelligence could have a huge impact on our healthcare systems going forward. I've said it here and I've written it on healthtechinsider.com over and over again, but I truly believe that the quantified self, the ability for wearable technology to document more information about ourselves, our bodies, and our health can lead to healthier people, better quality of life, and lower healthcare costs, all of which are important features. But the big question is whether or not we're actually able to achieve those kinds of benefits. So the big problem going forward is documenting these kinds of gains and demonstrating without a doubt that those kinds of gains are really there. Fortunately, there's study after study after study coming out that are showing that there's real benefits to be had from this sort of thing. One of the most recent ones is a study that was put out by a company called Springbuck, and it was called Wearable Technology Unlocking ROI of Workplace Wellness. ROI stands for Return on Investment, and that's the big deal. A lot of companies, large and small, are self-insured. They don't buy health insurance for their employees. Instead, they pay their medical bills out of a pool of money that they set aside. And so they're very concerned about the healthcare costs and the health of their employees. The interesting thing about this report is it covers a company that has more than 20,000 employees. A few years ago, they started a wellness program and allowed workers to opt in. The workers who opted in were given a big discount on buying a fitness tracker. They gave them a choice of different Fitbit models that they could use. Then they encouraged them to use the Fitbit and exercise, and they had competitions and challenges and so forth. About 1,000 employees took advantage of the wellness program. The interesting thing about this study is that it was a retrospective study, so that it didn't start looking at what happened when they started this program. They waited until a couple of years after the program had been running, and then they went back and looked to see if they could find any differences between those who were in the program and those who weren't. And so what they did was they identified about 1,800 other employees who matched those in the test group. They matched for things like age, gender, health history, weight, those kinds of things. Then they looked to see what differences there might have been in terms of healthcare. The results were amazing. The employees who opted into the wellness program ended up costing their employers $1,100 less every year compared with the control group. That's a 25% reduction in healthcare costs, which is a significant savings. The bulk of the gain came from those employees who were less active. So the ones who were already active didn't see a whole lot of change, but for the ones who were less active, the wellness program resulted in behaviors that improved their health and cut their health claims costs in half for that inactive group. Altogether, these savings were more than $1 million just in the span of this case study. That's a lot of money saved, especially when you consider the test group was only 5% of the total workforce for this company. If they could save $1,000 a year on every employee, that would be an enormous savings for them. So this is just one more study, but the point is that there's strong indication that companies who invest in wellness programs and wearable health tech devices could stand to save an enormous amount of money when it comes to the health care of their employees. And this doesn't even get into increased productivity, fewer sick days, all those secondary losses that come about when an employee has a health problem. So I expect we're going to see a lot more positive results like this in the future as more and more companies take advantage of this technology and start experimenting to see if they can indeed save money themselves. One of the most amazing things to me about modern medicine is this whole new field of what they call minimally invasive surgery. It used to be that if you had to get at somebody's insides, you have to open them up and peel them open and get your hands in there. Minimally invasive surgery is done completely differently. You make tiny incisions, the half inch or smaller, and through that you insert a catheter-like device called a trocar. It's a tube that you insert and steer to the area that you want to work. And through that tube, you send down cameras and lights and all miniature, very tiny, and tiny little surgical instruments. It might require two or three incisions for different devices to come at it. There's some new procedures that only require a single incision. But the problem with all of this is that the surgeon is then flying blind. The body's not open. You can't see what you're doing. You can't see your instruments. And so you have to rely on medical imaging, which for the most part is only two-dimensional. So you're just seeing a slice of the body and you're trying to guess where your piece is, and it's very hard to know whether you've gone too deep or not deep enough, and it takes lots of practice and great skill to make this all work. There's a company called Cambridge Consultants, and they're working on a new augmented reality system that could help surgeons when doing this minimally invasive surgery. The way it works is they wear goggles, which then superimposes on the patient's body a three-dimensional view of their insides and shows them where their instruments are exactly in three dimensions and makes it easier for them to see what they're doing. These three-dimensional images are created from multiple sources of medical imaging technology and combined to create this visual simulated view of the inside of the patient's body. It also can display vital signs, information, and other important data so that the surgeon can maintain concentration on the procedure that they're doing without having to look away to some other screen in the operating room while they're working. This system is still under development, and it's not quite ready for clinical applications yet, but it could make these kinds of procedures faster, more accurate, and safer, which will all benefit the patients by producing a better outcome. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Presenting Marty Winston on Home Automation.
Does anybody out there play Fallout? If you did, you might have heard an old song, the lyric of which begins, "I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart." Isn't that sweet? Well, I was thinking about what happens if the world is set on fire, at least the world in your neighborhood. You know, grass fire, a fence fire, a tree fire, your neighbor's burning. You know, these things can catch your place on fire. And as good as we are about indoor smoke detection, fire detection, all of that stuff, we really are not very good at detecting fires outdoors. So I've started doing some homework, trying to figure out what does it take to add the ability to a house to detect an outdoor fire. Now, if we limit ourselves to the fires that I've just mentioned, it greatly simplifies the task. Complicating the task is a desire to view more than a few dozen yards away from the house. You just want to get to a 100 yards, 200 yards. Equipment may give you some fits. And then there's the whole idea of 360-degree protection. Some of the really expensive stuff, and I'm talking about $5,000 sensors, has a field of view of 90 degrees. So with a little bit of a gap in the middle, you know, don't be that unlucky. With a little bit of a gap in the middle, you can use four of these to cover a full 360. Much better if you can choose not to ignore that edge gap to let five of these cover three. So, you know, there's $25,000 worth of sensors, and your house probably is worth that much, but is the protection worth that much? It's a hard decision. So I was thinking, okay, fine. Those are using multispectral technologies. They look for invisible combustion in the ultraviolet. They look for visible combustion in the infrared. They look for heat signatures. They look for a lot of things at once. But they're built for storage yards and ships and petroleum processing plants. They're built to deal with much more significant, much larger scale hazards and the need to detect them very certainly and very early. What can we do to bring that down? Well, I did see somebody had a little circuit you could plug into an Arduino that would detect a flame up to roughly arm's length on a cigarette lighter. That's not quite the scale we're looking for either. But it is an infrared sensor, and that starts the wheels turning. If infrared output from a flame, if that long-wave heat signature, long-wave infrared heat signature is what we need, and by the way, as you raise temperature, it becomes shorter wave and gets closer to what it's easy for just below optical sensors to see, although it may be some range below optical, it's a lot easier than trying to detect, for example, your body heat. Well, now, wait a minute. Aren't there little remote read thermometers you can use for the baby to tell if the baby's running a fever? Aren't there thermometers you can use on yourself, on your walls, on your windows? Remote read thermometers are very close to what we're doing, but how many of those would you need for a 360-degree circle? And what is their range? A lot of uncertainty here. A lot of uncertainty. And that got me to thinking, wait a minute. If we're already going to ring the house with video surveillance cameras, how deep into infrared do they go? And how deep into infrared can they go? Well, I'm not going to cheat on this one. I don't know the answer yet, but I am thinking about it. I've sent messages out to several companies who have outdoor operable flame detectors to see what they can tell me about what they're looking for and to see if maybe there's something out there that we can adapt. You know, if there's a $50 or $60 detector and I can get eight of them to cover a circle or 12 of them to cover a circle, it's a lot less than $25,000, and that may be worth exploring. Still, the whole idea of being so well protected indoors, because, of course, we are people and we are the source of most hazards because we're careless, and fires happen because of things we do and don't do. Most fires do, but once a fire does happen, once that fire is outdoors, because we're just as careless with the barbecue grill or with burning the leaves or whatever else we're doing, carelessness is not limited to inside the house. So once we're careless outdoors, there can be a fire anywhere. We had a fence fire at our house, and it happened because the kid next door thought raking the compost against the fence was a good idea. He had not heard of, or if he had heard of, had not been fully aware of the nature of spontaneous combustion. So we lost a couple of trees. That section of fence needed to be replaced. We were okay with our house because that house that where the fire started had a crew there putting up solar panels. At least he's conscientious, and he was very good about handling the cost of repairs. And that crew found hoses and water and put the fire out almost before we could get outside and respond to it. We finally figured out there had been a fire because the dog was barking at everybody. Okay, that gets you thinking? If you don't have a fire dog, you know, if you don't have a dog that's going to bark when there's a fire half a block away, two doors away, next door in the yard, if you don't have that, what can you make electronically to be your fire dog? Can you get a surveillance camera outdoors that can scan that selected bandwidth down in infrared where flames are likely to occur? Do you have the ability to optically recognize a flame? Is there something in object recognition? There are so many ways to attack this. You can look at temperatures, which may or may not take a lawnmower out. That's a hot engine. Temperatures may or may not be a good indicator. the indication of incandescence, which is the nature of flame itself, that glowing may or may not be part of what you're dealing with, because reflections of the sun, while they're at different parts of the optical spectra, can wash out the ability of a sensor, just overwhelm it to see the pieces of bandwidth you're interested in. And you remember from school that the nature of what you're burning changes somewhat the color and color temperature of the flame that is happening anyway. So you've got an infrared signature, you've got a visual signature, you've got a temperature signature. What you don't have is a cheap way to deal with this. And I don't either. But I do want to tell you that I'm on it. And if you've got a great solution, by all means, go to the website, go through the email there. I know the guys will get it to me and may find some other stuff to talk about it. I don't want to set your heart on fire. I don't want to set the world on fire, and I sure don't want my house set on fire. But I wouldn't mind a cigar right now. So back to you.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. The Westchester PCs Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, June 1st, 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, room number 101 in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their general meeting on Friday, June the 2nd. Starting time is 8 p.m. They will meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located on 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on video and still camera technology on Tuesday, June the 6th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have their meeting on smart phone ride services Thursday, June 8th, 2 p.m. This is a different time from the normal time that they have their general meeting. It will be held at the Community Room, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its general meeting Thursday, June 8th, 2017 at 7 p.m. Topic of presentation is Video Editing 101. It will be held at NYU, 65th Avenue. It's near Prince Street, room 150. This is a different location for the month, located at Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Mac Users Group will be meeting on Friday, June 9th at NYIT, that's New York Institute of Technology, at Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, in the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting on Tuesday, June the 13th. Meeting time starts at 7:15 p.m. They meet at the Rasser Room of the Palisades Mall on the fourth floor, located at West Nyack, New York. The Princeton PC's Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, June the 27th, Community Room of the Princeton Public Library in Princeton, New Jersey. And finally, the Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting Thursday, June the 29th, 2017, 6:45 p.m. Presentation is Tune Up Your Windows PC, Middletown Library in the Large Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. All these meetings are open to the public. They hope that you're going to be able to make some of them. The website for the Personal Computer Radio Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.